also a lecturer in UCLA's Labor Studies program, where he taught courses in Labor Studies and Asian American Studies. You've been listening to an interview I did with him exactly 3 months to the day that he passed away at age 69 on October 8th. I'm Sonali Kohatkar, host and executive producer of Rising Up with Sonali, an independently produced, subscriber-supported program nationally syndicated to radio stations, free speech TV, and podcast platforms.
KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you. David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. 30 years ago, some say it was 1 million, some say it was 2 million. Newspapers tried to say it was just 10,000. I'm being facetious, but many people remember the momentous gathering that took place in Washington, D.C. This is the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March. And I wanted to reflect on that. It was a special time, not just that day, but the work that was put into leading up to it. There was a lot of conversation, a lot of community built. Seeing an idea come to fruition was very powerful. And in the aftermath, there were very tangible results. I think for many people, it was life-changing. Joining us to talk about that in also looking at some of the issues that are happening 30 years later is Minister Abul Sabar Muhammad, formerly known as Minister Keith, over here in the Oakland chapter of the Nation of Islam. I'm always calling you Minister Keith, but Minister Abul Abdul. 30 years ago, what do you remember about that? And I want to start off with just the organizing, because I remember folks were going around from city to city, church to church, to youth centers, any place that there was a gathering of people, and very meticulously explaining what was going to be happening October 16th, 1995.
Well, the mid-90s were a very unique period of our history where there were many great threats being made against Black people, most notably Black men and boys, who were being portrayed in media as public enemy number one. Some of our friends in media made great films, but if the only film that represents you is to see us presented as gangbangers, thugs, threats, it would turn out that when law enforcement and policymakers would begin to address Black life in America, we were addressed as a people worthy to be dismissed, incarcerated. If we were from out of the country, we'd be in the deportation lines right now. And we saw the handwriting on the wall, especially when Black political leaders began to chime in, calling for and making demands for enhanced and increased law enforcement methods in handling.
Can we go back just a second on that? Because I think that's a real important point about what was going on with black elected officials in the 90s, because there's been a rewriting of history, and some of those folks who we all know, right, because I was covering that a lot, are kind of rewriting the script. It's almost like they were saying they marched with Dr. King, and some of them are saying, oh yeah, you know, mass incarceration is a bad thing, but they were the ones that really were pushing, you know, then President Clinton, like, if you really love black people, you're going to put more, you know,
right,
you're going to build more jails. And I think that's an insidious part of history that's been completely rewritten by some of those people.
Well, you know, brother, I grew up in Los Angeles, and there, with the crack epidemic coming up, there actually was a law enforcement routine that calls a rap group to make a song called The Bat-A-Ram. And that was an armored personnel vehicle when the claims were being made that they could not breach the doors of crack houses. They took a tank and ran it through South Central LA and would go through the front wall of people's homes. And I think the only thing that seemed to stop it is they went into the wrong homes. And the outcry from some that came up that this is illegal search and seizure, you're violating the Constitution, you're using a tank in the streets of Los Angeles to attempt to put fear in the hearts of those that you allege are gang members. Well, Minister Farrakhan, having been inspired by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad to warn our people that the government's wars that are often targeted abroad, that whatever is targeted abroad, you should know they've got a target on your chest as well. So he went through the cities with a series of lectures called Stop the Killing, wherein he would bring in gang members privately. And I was blessed to be in some of those sessions where he met with Crip leaders and Blood leaders. I lived in Los Angeles at the time. But in every major city that he visited, something similar happened. Well, as that was unfolding and people were crying out for higher levels of law enforcement, the reality is that law enforcement has never been our friend. And that when you study the history of policing in America, it found its origins in chasing down escaped slaves. And she plays out her birthright with us on far too many occasions. So the minister grew from the Stop the Killing messages to a series of messages called Men Only meetings that were really based on the same principle, that we've got to reach, teach, and touch the heart, soul, and mind of black men. So in New York City, while having a Men Only meeting, the minister made for the first time on inspiration the clarion call for the Million Man March. Well, that went on. It began to organize in various cities, men-only meetings. Houston drew, I think, 35,000 men to a church and its auxiliary buildings. Atlanta drew tens of thousands of men. Not only were there men-only meetings, that evolved into women-only meetings. And similarly, these tens and thousands of people were coming out because everyone knew that in order for the black community to change, we're going to have to change it with our own two hands. We can't wait and rely to see what government will do. So as that was unfolding and the images of black men were increasingly worsening, it just would happen that in 1995, weeks ahead of the Million Man March, our brother O.J. Simpson's case was resolved, to the great anger of white America and to the great joy of many of us, not because we understood or misunderstood his guilt nor innocence, but because no black man, it seemed, had never won in a lynch mob court process a victory. So you found that many black folk were cheering, many white folk were crying because we had never seen a victory in a courtroom. Well, going that forward toward the Million Man March, the organizing efforts that occurred all over the country, including in Oakland and San Francisco and Los Angeles, cities across America, was so profound that you could tell that the hand of God was on the organizers, because it seemed that no matter what we thought our differences were, for that call, we united. So we saw the consequence, the end result at the Million Man March, but what many didn't see was a meeting at Bethel AME Church with community leaders, with Minister Farrakhan in September of 85. What many didn't see was a meeting at Jeffrey's Inner Circle, introducing organizing efforts by the Reverend Ben Chavis to the Bay Area. What many didn't see were churches that, even if they didn't come to those meetings, they were organizing within their churches on how to participate at the Million Man March. Many didn't see or understand the structure of the African Methodist Episcopal churches that organized all over the country, which is why at the Million Man March, we saw a delegation that included the legendary Bishop Brookins from Southern California and many others who participated at the Million Man March. And so there was so much heading into it. One point I will share involves the family of Malcolm X. And I think that our listeners should really know this. For 30 years at that point, the Nation of Islam had been accused falsely of having a role in the assassination of Brother Malcolm. But a few months ahead, or a year ahead of the Million Man March, Malcolm's daughter, Kubila, was arrested and charged with alleging to have hired a hitman to harm Minister Farrakhan. Minister Farrakhan's response to that allegation, that was the first time the FBI came to him saying, "We're coming to protect you." And we protect us from what? Well, we have reason to believe that a daughter of Malcolm X has hired a hitman to kill you. The minister went immediately through their plots and plans to further divide the community, and he went to the defense of Sister Kubila and became the primary defender of Sister Kubila. And on May the 6th of 1995 at the Apollo Theater, Minister Farrakhan and the wife of Malcolm, Dr. Betty Shabazz, had a public meeting to demonstrate their reconciliation. So when we get to the march in October, one of the greatest images I love to see, and it's hard to find, are images of Dr. Betty Shabazz, the wife of Minister Farrakhan and the wife of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, together on the stage at the Million Man March.
Yeah, very powerful images and very powerful backstories leading up to it. What I recall about a lot of the organizing was the Clarion Call wasn't just for gathering, but it was about atonement. And I think that's what drove a lot of people. Can we talk a little bit about what that meant and how that was hitting with people, especially with what was going on in the backdrop? It wasn't just a men's only meeting, because I think some people, they hear that and they're like, what are you talking about? But there was a very distinct purpose, if I recall, that we were being charged with in terms of changing mindset and moving in a whole other direction.
You know, as we approached the theme of atonement, the minister having a meeting with these men where he made the call for the Million Man March, he did not initiate the theme of atonement until a little later. The first thing was to stop the killing and the violence among ourselves, because we're inviting our enemy to our door. Then, as we were going forward, there was a Final Call article, and I would hope that I can encourage the readers to go finalcall.com as often as you can to keep updated with the efforts of the Nation of Islam, and it was on the Final Call cover that said, "Why a Million Man March?" And at that time, in the early parts of our struggle to develop, the theme was, one of them, was to make America know her sins. And you know, just the presence of nearly 2 million black men in the mall raises the obvious question, why are you here? And then the answer became to atone for our shortcomings, to atone to our own families, to atone with each other, to unite. So if we start asking, why are we so divided? Many times it's because we haven't had an open and an honest conversation with each other about what we think to be our differences. And while we're divided, we have an enemy who's organized and united. And that's whether they call themselves Democrats or Republicans. We catch hell from both ends of that boat. So it's not simply a matter of which white political party we are a part of. The question became, what are we going to do and is for ourselves? So the principles of atonement, I don't think that we went expecting that America would atone. You made some reference that a reparations bill has gone down in flames again. And this is after 40 plus years of H.R. 40, produced by our representative, may Allah be pleased with him, John Conyers, that could not break out of committee. You have a president that is removing references to what we suffered from museums, from schools, from anything where government is concerned. Some say they're wiping the web pages of the U.S. military free of the existence of the Tuskegee Airmen. So they don't want to go through the steps of atonement with us, because the very first step is to point out what's wrong. If you erase what's wrong, you're not accepting or acknowledging what is wrong. But that's not inconsistent with what the Honorable Elijah Muhammad taught us. He taught us that there's no mercy and justice in the heart of our enemy for us. So if we are making an appeal to the conscience of America, I think our great brother Kwame Ture said, America doesn't have a conscience. So for you to appeal to the moral conscience of a country that doesn't have a moral conscience, you're barking up the wrong tree, if you will. Now we're being focused in on organizing ourselves. And on that day, we made a demonstration of how great and peaceful our unity efforts can be when guided on the right spirit.
You know, there were many examples of, as you said, people coming from different walks of life, people that had quote unquote beefs, you know, coming together. What stood out was seeing the Dominican and Puerto Rican brothers, you know, speaking at that march. You know, people from different denominations, it seemed to be a burying of the hatchet. Jesse Jackson spoke at that thing. And, you know, I didn't go to D.C., but if you recall, people that didn't go, they either watched and they were doing community here, you know, in their respective cities. And so that was pretty powerful. And what I remember in some of those gatherings was people answering the question, what are we going to do from here? What projects will we undertake? What did you see in the aftermath of that? Because I recalled people being really on a whole other mindset, like, you know, I really want to improve things. So what do you recall? What were some of the outtakes, you know, the not fallout, but the results of that moving forward after the mm-hmm. march?
Well, first, the march was an overwhelming success in every way that you can calculate it. On that day, there was not a single incident in D.C. that produced a police arrest. There was not a fight on that day. I didn't witness an argument on that day in a city whose population is similar to Oakland, 400,000 or 500,000 people. 1.5 million black men came from out of town to participate on that day. And yet the entire city went without a single arrest. Now, among the challenges that were given to the black men, where there was great success, one, we organized to politically organize ourselves, and it turned out that at the mall that day, 250,000 black men registered to vote that day. And the greatest change in voter activity in the coming elections was the voter participation of black people, with millions registering and participating in a way that had not been seen for many years. Crime found itself reducing across the country in major cities. Here in Oakland, as an example, there would come a group that didn't come directly out of the Million Man March, but indirectly it did. The group was known as Black Men First. And I believe you were a participant there, was headed by Pastor Bob Jackson initially. And those brothers came together and recited the Million Man March pledge every time we met, and would go out at night before these operations and government functions that now exist for peacekeeping. There were Black Men First inspired. So when we left the mall that day, we had instructions to go and join an organization that was working for our people. Go back to your churches. It was not a call for the brothers to join the Nation of Islam. And you know, unbeknownst to many, if you haven't read the follow-ups, more than 90% of the men there were Christian.
Yeah.
And of the Muslims that were there, I don't have an exact number, but I would say about 5% of the men there were the members of the Nation of Islam. So you had thousands, whatever that number was, of our brothers holding together nearly 2 million men. You know, so we certainly respect and appreciate the broad shoulders and faith of those men who stood on their feet, many for 12 hours or more, to keep that day peaceful. The program actually went from 6 a.m. to about 7 p.m. And we didn't find relief in the sense of, if you came to a smaller event or a mosque meeting, there's enough brothers to rotate our assignments. Yeah. Brother, I went to the Million Man March. I didn't expect to do anything but work. I had a camera in my hand. I didn't even bring my film. I just brought the camera just in case. And I want to thank the members of the black press that were near me. When they saw I was standing on a stage with a camera and no film, brothers started handing me film. And I was able to capture, this is before digital, and I was able to capture some wonderful images from the stage of the Million Man March. There were 25,000 black children on adoption rolls. After the Million Man March, 25,000 plus applications went in that families, black families, would be able to adopt those children. And that happened. Those children that year were adopted. And even in our city, there were families in our mosque that participated in the adoptions of children. So there were many ways that there was a positive impact that was made. But much like the march itself, the enemy and their media trying to diminish its effect, they did the same thing with the aftermath of the march. Yeah. I was present on stage next to CNN cameras. I'll never forget it, Brother Davey. And I stood there for about 10 hours. And as they were announcing the crowd sizes during the morning, they came out at, I think, 6 in the morning and said there's more than 100,000 men here. They came out at 8 in the morning and said there's 300,000 men here and hundreds of thousands are on the way. And then they came out at 10 in the morning and said, we are pleased to announce that there are now 1 million men in the mall. I'm next to CNN, a director and camera right next to me. And they said, what did they just announce? I said, they said there are 1 million people. Then the director looked at me and said, How many people do you think it is? I said, oh, it's about 1 million. And then they went on live television on CNN. She's listening in her headphones. And they made an announcement that there was something like 50,000 people. And the director turned around and looked at me with tears in her eyes.
And if you recall, they showed a part of the mall that had yet to be filled in. So they would never show those big shots. And so I remember watching, and it was like, man, they only got 50,000, and we didn't have digital. You didn't have no Facebook, no social media. So you were hearing like bits and pieces, like somebody would have an auntie or somebody who called from D.C. It's like, I just was down there. They got people for, as far as the eye can see, but they were not doing that. One of the things that I thought was also contested was the crime rate went down. And a lot of it was due to the commitments that people made to go back and figure out ways in which to engage folks. That was the other thing I recall people talking about, how you're going to start engaging younger people. And immediately what was being put was that crime was going down because this was around the time they were doing three strikes, right? So they were, so the argument was made it was broken windows policing, tough on crime laws, all that sort of stuff. Crime bill, which I think was 94, right? 94 was
it,
right?
Was.
Right. So they were trying to attribute the drop in crime to that versus the unprecedented efforts that were being made all around the country, you know, with brothers, which I thought was an interesting thing, because to this day, when we talk about crime, they will look at every single thing that you could think of except the Million Man March. They will say, you know, putting rabbits in a class and letting people pet them so they could relieve themselves of stress. That contributed to crime. Having people do cooking. I think in Arizona, they were painting the jail cells pink, right? Remember all that? Right? If we put pink colors in the jail, that will do it. Anything but to acknowledge, you know, 2 million people showing up at that mall and going home with a commitment.
And so many went home with commitments. I believe in Detroit, we're in October, and you'll have in cities people that jump out for Halloween. And at that time in Detroit, whatever occurred on Halloween night became a very violent affair. The black men who marched at the Million Man March went back into Detroit to determine they're not going to allow without intervention that wilding that had been going on in Detroit every year. And you know, I don't know if that violent behavior has returned. Those brothers have gone out and touched so many souls that although I don't celebrate Halloween, I don't eat much candy, however, to know that those men went out of love to organize themselves and to keep Detroit safe on Halloween's night, that's a testament to the Million Man March.
Let me ask you this. Here we are 30 years later looking back. So one thing, first we should acknowledge that there was a 10-year anniversary celebration.
Yes.
I think it was the millions more.
There were 5, 10, and 15 years.
Yeah.
Or 20 years.
20 years, right. So there's been that acknowledgement. Two things. One, are you surprised at where we are at right now? ICE agents running around, some black people defending it, you know, saying we need this, seeing what the Supreme Court is set to do. For people who don't know, they will probably eliminate almost every single black district throughout the South, from Alabama to the Carolinas, if they pull this law, if they rule on this, if they give this ruling today, which they expected to do. So you're talking about 20 black Congress people will no longer be in Congress starting next year if everything goes, you know, by what they plan to do. Gavin Newsom, right here in California, after a very long, hard-fought battle with many organizations to get a reparations bill that actually was put before him. So it passed. he just vetoed it. And then just the return of authoritarianism, tyranny, and what you've seen in Chicago, where you saw it was all black folks that were being doors kicked in and kids being zip tied. And just for the record, we've done several shows on it. That building was not the home of any gang member, since they used that as the pretense. That was all folks. You know, we've had everybody on Chicago from Fred Hampton Jr. on down that said that was not the case. Yet they found some Negroes to run up there with a camera and say, we need ICE. You know, so are you just shocked to see where we're at? Because just what is being depicted can be disheartening. What goes on behind the scenes, you may see this at a very, on a whole other level, but the state of things right now, are you surprised, disappointed? Where do we go from here?
I would say I'm not shocked, and I wouldn't say that I'm disappointed. But what we are looking at is the warning of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and his minister coming to fore, who have said, unite or perish, do for self or suffer the consequences. When he made the call for the Million Man March, the march itself stayed the hand of the enemy. Were it not for the march as it unfolded, we would likely have seen this 30 years ago or 20 years ago, because that was the direction that government was heading in, especially where we are concerned, at that time. So we were fighting what had become the public image. You see, once you are identified as a terrorist, then the president can drop a missile on a boat and claim that that little boat was responsible for all the fentanyl that have come into America. That is to say that we don't know what was on that boat. We don't know who was on that boat, because the boat had been obliterated. But once you say that these that we're targeting are, quote, narco-terrorists, then it opens the door for any manner of warfare against them. Well, you put that on what the image of the black man was becoming, and we were opening the door for any manner of law enforcement to operate against us. Even here in Oakland in 2009, when our brother Oscar was slain, the first thing the BART department said of him, not that he was dead, first thing they said was that he was a gang member.
I remember that.
So once you carry these labels and titles, and it turned out to be not true, he was from a community of young men who were proud to be friends. They weren't a gang. They were young men who befriended each other. If they ran into trouble, they would protect each other, just as if you and I, since we're from similar place, time, and experience, and if we were in some area where you came under threat, I'm going to defend my brother Davy. I got glasses, he got glasses. It don't make us a gang. It makes us brothers that are willing to protect each other. So once these labels are applied to black life, then black life doesn't matter to those that are enforcing. As we are watching the scourge against the immigrants right now, who's there to protect them? Well, our beloved minister has always been a defender of those who suffer injustice. Even into Palestine, same thing. These are terrorists. Hamas is running the city. Therefore, we're going to kill everybody in the city. And it's been acceptable in the eyes of the American government. And when you hear Mr. Trump come out and say things like they need to disarm, and if they don't disarm, we're going to go disarm them. Well, how do you intend to do that? Given that America is not at war with Hamas, how do you go in and disarm anybody? And if you attempt to go and disarm anybody, you don't expect them to respond in like to the force that you're bringing them? Now, they don't have the weapons to fight America, neither do we. Our weapon is our righteousness, our unity, our strength, and our love. Our unity, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, is a weapon more powerful than nuclear bombs. And what they saw at the Million Man March was a nuclear bomb of unity. And what its impact can be, we just have to work today to maintain, regain the spirit of the Million Man March, because the government is not who we can change, but what we can change are our own people. And when we're united, then those that would come against us are going to have to come different, because knowing that if a blow against you is a blow against me, and a blow against me is a blow against you, then they will know that the potential response that can come from us is one that has to be respected.
You know, as a side note, Minister Abdul Sabar is our guest, talking about the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March and what has unfolded since then. You mentioned Oscar Grant, and one of the things that is kind of erased from history, but you were there because I have pictures, was the 100 folks that showed up on the courthouse steps and then went in to see Tom Orloff, who was the DA at that time. That was a very powerful moment. One, because as I recall, he didn't want to meet with everybody, even though you had everybody from elected officials on down to, you know, folks off the block, right? And then when we got into that office, right, because he eventually had to let everybody, he didn't make no mention about gangbangers or anything like that, even though that was what was initially put out. In fact, he was trying initially to defend Johannes Mesley and didn't want to arrest him. It was that public pressure of all you folks that were there that really turned a tide that day, if you recall. I mean, maybe you could share your thoughts, but that, to me, is a momentous occasion. But it also was in the spirit of, like, everybody coming together, because everybody from all walks of life had come. And we also got to remember, that was on the eve of Obama, you know, ascending to the White House, right? So we hadn't even got to that point. He was still president-elect, you know,
that's right,
when all this was happening.
This was just weeks before his inauguration. And you could tell, even in the case of our brother president, that he was being advised how to refrain from engaging issues of great interest to the black community, such as the murder of Oscar Grant. So as we gathered on that day, you're correct, it was every faith, it was political officials, and yes, you're correct, the district attorney did not want to meet us at all. Now, we told him that we were coming. He never accepted to have a meeting. But the force of our unity among black folk from every walk of life, respected and unknown, known and unknown persons, who voiced our perspectives with intelligence, power, and strength. And I'll never forget when we went up that elevator. You know, we paid tribute a few days ago to the Reverend Dr. J. Alfred Smith Sr., who passed at 94, and he was one of the great ones there with us at that press conference.
Yeah.
When we got in the elevator, my pastor gave me a hug and cried, because he was happy to see a rising young group challenging the hand of government. And when we got up to have that meeting with the DA, he didn't want me in that meeting at all. In fact, Supervisor Keith Carson was called in on an emergency to come to see if he could calm us down, I guess. And the DA wanted to understand the situation, but Supervisor Carson was part of our delegation. And when he got off the elevator, he came to me and said, "Brother, what do you want me to tell him?" I said, "Well, you tell him we want to meet." He would not meet with me. Yeah. He met with Supervisor Carson and Pastor Smith. When they got in that room, they told him, "You need to meet with Brother Keith."
Yeah.
And I came into the meeting and we had our dialogue. And even when I entered, the DA didn't want to talk to me. Pastor Smith told him, when I walked in the room, "He's in charge, listen to him." Now, yeah. Pastor Smith could be my father. I didn't come in the room to be in charge. We came in the room to demand justice. And as you all know, the rest unfolded. The meeting we demanded with the DA did occur. He was frightened to come into that room.
Yeah, he said he was scared, but he let everybody in afterwards.
Right? Yeah.
Because the footage, I filmed that.
Yeah, you were there. And you know, he didn't want to come out. He said, we don't have a meeting space. And I said, well, you have courtrooms. Why don't we go into an empty courtroom? He said, I can't do that. I said, well, Laney College is up the block. We'll meet you at Laney College. I can't do that. The sheriffs wouldn't let him do that. So finally, he said, well, I have a meeting room, so let me see it. And we toured that space. And I said, brother, we can do it. Not brother, but we can have that meeting right here. And that's how that history unfolded. And as you know, he did his best to defend the relationship between the district attorney's office and law enforcement. He wouldn't concede anything. And I'll never forget that we said to him, you need to have a press conference and tell the public that you are considering charges or investigating whether charges are relevant against Johannes Mezeli. Because he said he's investigating. He said, I'm not going to do that. You do it. And our sister, Councilwoman Desley Brooks, looked at him and said, slavery is over. Yeah. You are the public servant. It is your job as a matter of public safety to say to the world what should be done. Well, he refused to do it, and Oakland was on fire by that night.
That night.
And the next day, Mayor Dellums called me and said to me, and may Allah be pleased with him, he said to me, I have an idea. He said, I've spoken to the DA. I'm going to have a press conference. And the DA has agreed to come into the press conference with me. And we are going to say that we are investigating the case against Johannes Mezeli. And he asked me to come and speak during that press conference because we were the ones that brought the idea. So I didn't mind the mayor saying he had an idea. Well, go ahead with your idea then, Mr. Mayor, and we'll stand with you. And of course, days later, charges were brought against Johannes Mezeli. But by that point, we had already begun to organize to remove the DA. We gave him options. You can retire, or you can face a recall, or you can just resign. Well, I guess he retired. He didn't resign. He took his benefits and his retirement package, and he went on with his business. So he did not prosecute the case against Johannes Mezeli. That was left to Ms. Nancy O'Malley.
Wow. Backstory on that is, you know, this past year was the 15th anniversary of the verdict.
Yes.
15th anniversary on July 8th.
Right? Yes, sir.
The same day that CNN covered the decision, right? And we thought the decision was going to be the verdict, and the decision was what team LeBron James is going to go on. Remember?
I was locked up on the case, brother. I didn't realize
I remember that. So the national story was the decision, and you're thinking like, yeah, because we were all waiting to find out, and it was like he's going to the Miami Heat, and then like as a sidebar, I don't even know if they even mention it nationally.
Well, it proves that the media has never really been our friend. One of the developments from the Million Man March until now was the growth and advent of social media. So even as the Grant case was unfolding, we were able to jump on Facebook and Twitter and whatever other forums that were available to us to say things to the community that otherwise would not have reached the community. So while we were there, after the verdict was made and we had a press conference, and you may recall, I spoke at the end of that press conference, myself and Sister Wanda.
Yeah.
And the reality is that the media did not want to hear us at the press conference. So when I got up to speak, they started folding up their cameras. Mm-hmm. I'm standing right in front. They're literally folding up their cameras and walking away. And Wanda whispered to me and said, may I say something? So she came on behind me, made them unpack those cameras. And that's when she said, my son was murdered. My son was murdered. My son was forced them. They had already determined what they were going to report or not report before they even came out there. And it was not their determination. And I've seen them do this with Minister Farrakhan many times, that they've already written a story. All they're trying to do is capture a couple of pictures. They want to see if he says something that they can use against him. And then they leave. I've seen it at Savior's Day. I've seen it with the minister at press conferences. I've seen it many times. Let me give you this as an example. In Washington, I believe it was in November of 2017 or 16, Minister Farrakhan had a press conference at the Watergate Hotel in which he outlined how presidents have all planned to do war with the Middle East and with black people, and he identified them. Mr. Trump was in office, and he said at that event that Mr. Trump would be the last president. Now, I don't know if he meant the last of the line that he recited, and he recited them back, I think, to Richard Nixon, but he said that he understood the mind or the thinking of these presidents in their wars that have been waged in the Middle East and against black people in America. Well, many heard him say Trump would be the last one, and we didn't know what that meant. We saw Mr. Biden. None of us could have ventured to guess there's any way a 34-time felon is going to return to office. But he did, and now we're looking at the consequences now, and who knows whether or not the Constitution will survive him.
Where do we go from here, knowing all that? And I'm asking it from the standpoint of black folks have dealt with authoritarianism. You know, what they're going to do with the Supreme Court is the legacy that we've had to endure of not having voter rights all throughout the South. There are some that say, well, none of this even matters. And there's others, you know, in those communities that are like, you know, that's a death toll. That's a death knell. You know, their representative, whether they got them 50 cents or $50, it will no longer be there in a completely politically dominant situation. So where do we go from here at this point?
Well, first, we want to acknowledge the great success or the benefits that we experience today that Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks and countless others fought for. When we travel to DC for the Million Man March, and when we travel or dine or all the things that we do where our lives have some comfort, we've not been told that we can't go into a fine restaurant because we're black, or we can't walk through the front door of a hotel because we're black. We're children of the 60s. Our parents went through that. Now that we've gained some comfort, you know, sometimes comfort can be your enemy, and it can reduce the creative flow that's required in order to think our way out of the condition that we're in. One of the greatest errors we've made is to attempt to integrate into a burning house. Dr. King told his friend Harry Belafonte that he feared that he was asking us to integrate into a house that's on fire. Ultimately, we're going to have to build a house of our own on this land or elsewhere that can be respected and protected and developed. We've got to teach our own. We can't rely on a school system that insists on lying to us. We're at the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March. How many of our children have heard of it from school? Mm-hmm. How many, I was speaking to an audience just recently of young people, and as we're talking, it's dawning on me that even their parents, we had a guest at our meeting last night, we were watching some of the footage from the Million Man March in a film called Long Live the Spirit of the Million Man March, available on YouTube, produced by a great brother named Glenn Lowry. And as this brother, who's 36 years old, tears are in his eyes watching the march before Minister Farrakhan came on. And at the end, they showed the minister's pledge to the million men. And this brother is reciting the pledge from a video footage of 30 years ago. He's 36 years of age. He may be a parent now. He could be a husband now. But he was not of age to have been present at the Million Man March. That event should be in every curriculum in every school in the country. Could juxtapose the Million Man March and its peace to January the 6th when Mr. Trump thought he lost an election. Well, he did lose the election. You compare what happened when they've gathered to when we gather. There is no comparison. So the power of our unity, we haven't demonstrated it enough. That's why I was so honored to participate in the services for our brother J. Alfred Smith Jr. I don't want anyone to think that because they are Christian and we are Muslim, that we are different. Or if I like jazz and you like hip hop, that doesn't make us different. And by the way, I like hip hop too. I'm an old school earth, wind, and fire kind of guy, but certainly music is music. It's universal. And there's so much that we have to unite on. We just have not made the outright effort to separate and organize ourselves. We've been segregated, but we've not separated. And there's a difference. Segregation is a law that determines one is superior, the other is inferior. And those who are inferior are assigned a place to live, assigned a school to go to, assigned employment that's available to you. That's segregation. Separation is a choice that I make that's in keeping with the biblical saying that says, come out of her, my people, lest you be partakers in her sins and afflicted by her plagues. Now, we're not going back to Africa anytime soon in mass. There's not enough navies to get us there. But if we are here, you know, they say politics starts local. Can we organize where we are to make our communities cleaner and safer? Can we organize where we are to ensure more equitable public services are available to us? The answer is yes. So when our mayors and our council members and others really want to engage the public to see what's needed and to provide a service, we just hope that the president doesn't cut everybody off before they can get a service rolling. But if we rely more on what we have locally and less on what federal can provide, then we'll find a greater measure of success.
That's a good point to end on. Minister Abdul Sabur Muhammad, formerly known as Minister Keith, if you recognize the voice, we appreciate you coming on, sharing with us your thoughts, giving us something maybe to chew on and build on as we look back to the 30th anniversary of the Million Man March and the variety of issues that emerged from that. So we have challenges in front of us, but I'm confident that we will overcome them as we had in the past.
We're going to take a break. If I can say, brother, long live the spirit of the Million Man March. And on Sunday, October the 19th, the national event will be webcasted. You can watch it at www.noi.org. And if you go to that webpage, you can get the times and viewing opportunities.
There you have it. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We're out for now. Peace.
Hard Knock Radio. We're rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
And my last name is Susana. Yeah, yeah.
Due to unprecedented civil unrest, all forms of protest are now classified as acts of terrorism. This is not a test. This is not a test.
Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grabber, tyrant. By the toe, flashes, puppet show, line them up like dominoes. Never bow to a in a toupee, yelling free speech, but controlling what the news say. The Lorax called, it's time to find a new shade. RuPaul's never seen a beat that bad on Drag Race. Ain't it obvious the person in the office is a racist? Brad came in the mail, but he opposes immigration. And someone's Abuelita, not a foreign armed invasion. That would be the mass man reading graduation ceremonies. Unmarked van snatching people out the street. Broken Amendments fought 10 and 14 at least. But please tell me again, oh, this is still democracy?
a test.
Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line him up like dominoes. Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line him up like dominoes. Please explain it to me. The man in charge of the economy's got 6 bankruptcies. Huh? Asking ChatGPT to define GDP, defunding education when half the country can't read. Well, now it's clicking for me. You need the people asleep, and knowledge is the greatest threat to propaganda machines. Remember, books don't burn, they just quietly vanish. So don't wait till it's too late to panic. Iceberg, Titanic, threat level orange. Don't you see that they're ignoring our rights? It's fascism wrapped in red, blue, and white. Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line him up like dominoes. Coward, traitor, liar, foe, grab a tyrant by the toe. Fascist puppet show, line him up like
dominoes.
It's a threat level orange.
Warning.
It's a threat level orange.
Warning.
It's a threat level orange. Threat level orange.
The American dream's like any other. Open your eyes and it's gone.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Cam. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, just imitation. Simulation, step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio, let's go. Big shout to Need and Davey D. Yeah, right, feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on.
Check out.
Why every novice pick they Hard Knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat to the belly from the steel gray beef. Say please. I'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread making a speech. Say you peace to the lovers, I'm neighbor to please. Make some shade on your name in the street. Good, it ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast, Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
East Coast.
Is Bird Note. The bufflehead is a teeny duck with a big ol' noggin. The back of the male's head is white, and the rest is glossy black. But look carefully at a bufflehead, and you might see something special. When sunlight hits their dark head feathers at the right angle, their colors transform into shades of the rainbow, from deep violet to green and gold. The bufflehead's feathers are iridescent. That means they're structured in a way that acts like a prism, splitting light into different wavelengths. So the feather seems to change colors when seen from different angles. It's iridescence that gives peacocks, birds of paradise, and hummingbirds their magical hues, like something out of a fantasy novel. But there are also less famously flashy birds with surprising iridescence. Common grackles, caught in bright sunlight, gleam gold, green, and blue-purple. Starlings, too. And a closer look at the dull gray rock pigeon shuffling around a city park might reveal the shifting shades of electric teal and lavender on their throats. Birds are fantastic creatures, down to the faintest illumination. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is KBOO Portland.
Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, October 18th from 12 to 5 for live coverage of No Kings demonstrations across the country, produced by Pacifica Radio and KBOO News. We'll hear on the